He's not like you, thank God. He wouldn't soil his hands as you do, making money with carpetbaggers and scalawags and Yankees. He's scrupulous and honorable. But not too scrupulous and honorable to take aid and money from a woman. What else could he have done?
Who am I to say? I only know what I did, both when I was thrown out and nowadays. I only know what other men have done. We saw opportunity in the ruin of a civilization, and we made the most of our opportunity, some honestly, some shadily. And we are still making the most of it. But the Ashleys of this world have the same chances and don't take them. They just aren't smart, Scarlet. And only the smart deserve to survive.
She hardly heard what he was saying. For now there was coming back to her the exact memory which had teased her a few minutes before when he first began speaking. She remembered the cold wind that swept the orchard of Tara, and Ashley standing by a pile of rails, his eyes looking beyond her. And he had said, "What?" Some funny foreign name that sounded like profanity, and had talked of the end of the world. She had not known what he meant then, but now bewildered comprehension was coming to her, and with it a sick, weary feeling. "Why, Ashley said..."
"Yes?"
"Once at Tara, he said something about the... dusk of the gods and about the end of the world and some such foolishness."
"Ah, the Götterdämmerung."
Rhett's eyes were sharp with interest.
"And what else?"
"Oh, I don't remember exactly. I wasn't paying much mind, but yes, something about the strong coming through and the weak being winnowed out."
"Ah, so he knows. Then that makes it harder for him. Most of them don't know and will never know. They wonder all their lives where the lost enchantment has vanished. They'll simply suffer in proud and incompetent silence. But he understands. He knows he's winnowed out."
"Oh, he isn't. Not while I've got breath in my body." He looked at her quietly, and his brown face was smooth. "Scarlet, how did you manage to get his consent to come to Atlanta and take over the mill? Did he struggle very hard against you?" She had a quick memory of the scene with Ashley after Gerald's funeral, and put it from her. "Why, of course not," she replied indignantly. "When I explained to him that I needed his help because I didn't trust that scamp who was running the mill, and Frank was too busy to help me, and I was going to... Well, there was Ella Lorena, you see... He was very glad to help me out."
"Sweet are the uses of motherhood. So that's how you got round him. Well, you've got him where you want him now, poor devil. As shackled to you by obligations as any of your convicts are by their chains, and I wish you both joy. But as I said at the beginning of this discussion, you'll never get another cent out of me for any of your little unladylike schemes, my double-dealing lady."
She was smarting with anger and with disappointment as well. For some time she had been planning to borrow more money from Rhett to buy a lot downtown and start a lumber yard there. "I can do without your money," she cried. "I'm making money out of Johnny Gallagher's mill, plenty of it, now that I don't use free darkies, and I have some money out on mortgages, and we're coining cash at the store from the darkie trade."
"Yes, so I heard. How clever of you to rook the helpless and the widow and the orphan and the ignorant. But if you must steal, Scarlet, why not steal from the rich and strong instead of the poor and weak? From Robin Hood on down to now, that's been considered highly moral."
"Because," said Scarlet shortly, "it's a sight easier and safer to steal, as you call it, from the poor." He laughed silently, his shoulders shaking.
"You're a fine, honest rogue, Scarlet."
"A rogue? Queer that that term should hurt. She wasn't a rogue," she told herself vehemently. "At least, that wasn't what she wanted to be. She wanted to be a great lady." For a moment, her mind went swiftly down the years, and she saw her mother, moving with a sweet swish of skirts and a faint fragrance of sachet, her small busy hands tireless in the service of others, loved, respected, cherished. And suddenly her heart was sick. "If you are trying to devil me," she said tiredly, "it's no use. I know I'm not as scrupulous as I should be these days, not as kind and pleasant as I was brought up to be. But I can't help it, Rhett. Truly I can't. What else could I have done? What would have happened to me, to Wade, to Tara, and all of us if I'd been gentle when that Yankee came to Tara? I should have been. But I don't even want to think of that. And when Jonas Wilkerson was going to take the home place, suppose I'd been kind and scrupulous. Where would we all be now? And if I'd been sweet and simple-minded and not nagged Frank about bad debts, we'd... Oh, well, maybe I am a rogue. But I won't be a rogue forever, Rhett. But during these past years, and even now, what else could I have done? How else could I have acted? I felt that I was trying to row a heavy loaded boat in a storm. I've had so much trouble just trying to keep afloat that I couldn't be bothered about things that didn't matter. Things I could part with easily and not miss, like good manners and, well, things like that. I've been too afraid my boat would be swamped, and so I've dumped overboard the things that seemed least important. Pride and honor and truth and virtue and kindliness. He enumerated silkily. You are right, Scarlet. They aren't important when a boat is sinking. But look around at your friends. Either they are bringing their boats ashore safely with cargoes intact, or they are content to go down with all flags flying. They're a passel of fools, she said shortly. There's a time for all things. When I've got plenty of money, I'll be as nice as you please, too. Butter won't melt in my mouth. I can afford to be then.
You can afford to be, but you won't. It's hard to salvage jettisoned cargo, and if it's retrieved, it's usually irreparably damaged. And I fear that when you can afford to fish up the honor and virtue and kindness you've thrown overboard, you'll find they have suffered a sea change and not, I fear, into something rich and strange.
He rose suddenly and picked up his hat. You are going?
Yes. Aren't you relieved? I leave you to what remains of your conscience.
He paused and looked down at the baby, putting out a finger for the child to grip.
I suppose Frank is bursting with pride?
Oh, of course.
Has a lot of plans for this baby, I suppose.
Oh, well, you know how silly men are about their babies.
Then tell him, said Rhett, and stopped short. An odd look on his face. Tell him if he wants to see his plans for his child work out. He'd better stay home at night more often than he's doing.
What do you mean?
Just what I say. Tell him to stay home.
Oh, you vile creature! To insinuate that poor Frank would...
Oh, good Lord! Rhett broke into a roar of laughter. I didn't mean he was running around with women. Frank! Oh, good Lord! He went down the steps, still laughing.
Chapter 44. The March afternoon was windy and cold, and Scarlet pulled the lap robe high under her arms as she drove out the Decatur Road toward Johnny Gallagher's mill. Driving alone was hazardous these days, and she knew it, more hazardous than ever before. For now the Negroes were completely out of hand. As Ashley had prophesied, there had been hell to pay since the legislature refused to ratify the amendment. The stout refusal had been like a slap in the face of the furious North, and retaliation had come swiftly. The North was determined to force the Negro vote on the state, And to this end, Georgia had been declared in rebellion and put under the strictest martial law. Georgia's very existence as a state had been wiped out, and it had become, with Florida and Alabama, Military District Number 3, under the command of a federal general. If life had been insecure and frightening before this, it was doubly so now. The military regulations, which had seemed so stringent the year before, were now mild by comparison with the ones issued by General Pope. Confronted with the prospect of Negro rule, the future seemed dark and hopeless, and the embittered state smarted and writhed helplessly. As for the Negroes, their new importance went to their heads, and realizing that they had the Yankee army behind them, their outrages increased. No one was safe from them. In this wild and fearful time, Scarlet was frightened. Frightened but determined. And she still made her rounds alone, with Frank's pistol tucked in the upholstery of the buggy. She silently cursed the legislature for bringing this worst disaster upon them all. What good had it done? This fine, brave stand. This gesture which everyone called gallant. It had just made matters so much worse. As she drew near the path that led down through the bare trees into the creek bottom, where the shantytown settlement was, she clucked to the horse to quicken his speed. She always felt uneasy driving past this dirty, sordid cluster of discarded army tents and slab cabins. It had the worst reputation of any spot in or near Atlanta. For here lived in filth outcast Negroes, black prostitutes, and a scattering of poor whites of the lowest order. It was rumored to be the refuge of Negro and white criminals, and was the first place the Yankee soldiers searched when they wanted a man. Shootings and cuttings went on here with such regularity that the authorities seldom troubled to investigate, and generally left the shantytowners to settle their own dark affairs. Back in the woods, there was a still that manufactured a cheap quality of corn whiskey, and by night, the cabins in the creek bottoms resounded with drunken yells and curses. Even the Yankees admitted that it was a plague spot and should be wiped out, but they took no steps in this direction. Indignation was loud among the inhabitants of Atlanta and Decatur who were forced to use the road for travel between the two towns. Men went by shantytown with their pistols loosened in their holsters, and nice women never willingly passed it, even under the protection of their men, for usually there were drunken Negro slatterns sitting along the road, hurling insults and shouting coarse words. As long as she had Archie beside her, Scarlet hadn't given shantytown a thought, because not even the most impudent Negro woman dared laugh in her presence. But since she had been forced to drive alone, there had been any number of annoying, maddening incidents. The Negro sluts seemed to try themselves whenever she drove by. There was nothing she could do except ignore them and boil with rage. She couldn't even take comfort in airing her troubles to the neighbors or family, because the neighbors would say triumphantly, "Well, what else did you expect?" And her family would take on dreadfully again and try to stop her. And she had no intention of stopping her trips. Thank heaven there were no ragged women along the roadside today. As she passed the trail leading down to the settlement, she looked with distaste at the group of shacks squatting in the hollow in the dreary slant of the afternoon sun. There was a chill wind blowing, and as she passed there came to her nose the mingled smells of wood smoke, frying pork, and untended privies. Averting her nose, she flapped the reins smartly across the horse's back and hurried him past and around the bend of the road. Just as she was beginning to draw a breath of relief, her heart rose in her throat with sudden fright, for a huge Negro slipped silently from behind a large oak tree. She was frightened, but not enough to lose her wits, and in an instant the horse was pulled up, and she had Frank's pistol in her hand. "What do you want?" she cried with all the sternness she could muster. The big Negro ducked back behind the oak, and the voice that answered was frightened. "Lord, Miss Scarlet, don't shoot Big Sam." Big Sam! For a moment, she couldn't take in his words. Big Sam, the foreman of Terra whom she had seen last in the days of the siege. What on earth? Come out of there and let me see if you're really Sam.
Reluctantly, he slid out of his hiding place. A giant, ragged figure, barefooted, clad in denim breeches and a blue Union uniform jacket that was far too short and tight for his big frame. When she saw it was really Big Sam, she shoved the pistol down into the upholstery and smiled with pleasure.
"Oh, Sam! How nice to see you!"
Sam galloped over to the buggy, his eyes rolling with joy and his white teeth flashing, and clutched her outstretched hand with two black hands as big as hams. His watermelon-pink tongue lapped out. His whole body wiggled, and his joyful contortions were as ludicrous as the gamblings of a mastiff.
"My lord, it sure is good to see some of the family again," he cried, scrunching her hand until she felt that the bones would crack. "How come you got so mean-like toting a gun, Miss Scarlet?"
"So many mean folks these days, Sam, that I have to tote it. What on earth are you doing in a nasty place like Shantytown? You, a respectable darky. And why haven't you been into town to see me?"
"Law, Miss Scarlet, I don't live in Shantytown. I just bide in here for a spell. I wouldn't live in that place for nothing. I never in my life seen such trashy niggers. And I didn't know you was in Atlanta. I thought you was at Terra. I was aiming to come home to Terra as soon as I got the chance."
"Have you been living in Atlanta ever since the siege?"
"No, ma'am. I've been traveling."
He released her hand, and she painfully flexed it to see if the bones were intact.
"'Member when you seed me last?"
Scarlet remembered the hot day before the siege began, when she and Rhett had sat in the carriage, and the gang of Negroes with Big Sam at their head had marched down the dusty street toward the entrenchment singing, "Go Down Moses." She nodded.
"Well, I worked like a dog digging breastworks and filling sandbags till the Confederates left Atlanta. The Captain Jimpman, what had me in charge, he was killed, and there weren't nobody to tell Big Sam what to do, so I just lay low in the bushes. I thought I'd try to get home to Terra, but then I hear that all the country round Terra done burnt up. Sides, I didn't have no way to get back, and I was scared the Paterolas pick me up, 'cause I didn't have no pass. Then the Yankees come in, and a Yankee gentleman, he was a colonel, he took a shine to me, and he keep me to tend to his hoss and his boots. Yes, ma'am. I sure did feel biggity, being a body servant like Polk, when I ain't nothing but a field hand. And I ain't tell the colonel I was a field hand, and he... Well, Miss Scarlet, Yankees is ignorant folks. He didn't know the difference. So I stayed with him, and I went to Savannah with him when General Sherman went there. And, for God, Miss Scarlet, I never seed such awful goings-on as I seed on the way to Savannah. A stealing and a burning. Did they burn Terra, Miss Scarlet?"
"They set fire to it, but we put it out."
"Well, am I sure glad to hear that. Terra my home, and I was aiming to go back there. And when the war over, the colonel, he say to me, 'You, Sam, you come on back north with me. I pays you good wages.' Well, like all the niggers, I was honing to try this year freedom, for I went home. And I goes north with the colonel. Yes'm. Us went to Washington and New York, and then to Boston where the colonel lib. Yes, ma'am. I's a traveled nigger. Miss Scarlet, there's more horses and carriages on them Yankee streets than you can shake a stick at. I was scared all the time I was going to get run over."
"Did you like it up north, Sam?" Sam scratched his woolly head.
"I did, and I didn't. The colonel, He a mighty fine man, and he understand niggers. But his wife, she something else. His wife, she called me Mister first time she seed me. Yes'm. She do dat, and I like to drop in my tracks when she do it. De Colonel, he tell her to call me Sam, and den she do it. But all them Yankee folks, first time they meet me, they call me Mr. O'Hara. And they asked me to sit down with them like I was just as good as they was. Well, I ain't never sat down with white folks, and I is too old to learn. They treat me like I was just as good as they was, Miss Scarlet, but in their hearts, they didn't like me. They didn't like no niggers. And they was scared of me, 'cause I's so big. And they was allus asking me about the bloodhounds that chase me and the beatings I got. And Lord, Miss Scarlet, I ain't never got no beatings. You know Mr. Gerald ain't gonna let nobody beat a spensive nigger like me. When I tell him that, and tell him how good Miss Ellen to the niggers, and how she sat up a whole week with me when I had the pneumonia, they don't believe me. And Miss Scarlet, I got to honing for Miss Ellen and Tara till it looked like I can't stand it no longer. And one night, I lit out for home, and I rid the freight cars all the way down to Atlanta. If you buy me a ticket to Tara, I sure be glad to get home. I sure be glad to see Miss Ellen and Miss Gerald again. I done had enough freedom. I want somebody to feed me good victuals regular, and tell me what to do and what not to do, and look after me when I get sick. Suppose I gets the pneumonia again. Is that Yankee lady gwine to take care of me? No, ma'am. She's gwine to call me Mr. O'Hara, but she ain't gwine to nurse me. But Miss Ellen, she gwine to nurse me. Do I get sick, and what's the matter, Miss Scarlet? Pa and Mother are both dead, Sam. Dead? Is you funnin' with me, Miss Scarlet? That ain't no way to treat me. I'm not funnin'. It's true. Mother died when Sherman's men came through Tara, and Pa, he went last June. Oh, Sam, don't cry. Please don't. If you do, I'll cry too, Sam. Don't. I just can't stand it. Let's don't talk about it now. I'll tell you all about it some other time. Miss Sue Ellen is at Tara, and she's married to a mighty fine man, Mr. Will Benteen. And Miss Corrine, she's in a... Scarlet paused. She could never make plain to the weeping giant what a convent was. She's living in Charleston now. But Pork and Prissy are at Tara. There, Sam, wipe your nose. Do you really want to go home?
Yes'm. But it ain't gwine be like I thought with Miss Ellen and...
Sam, how'd you like to stay here in Atlanta and work for me? I need a driver, and I need one bad with so many mean folks around these days.
Yes'm, you sure do. I been aiming to say you ain't got no business driving around by yourself, Miss Scarlet.
You ain't got no notion how mean some niggers is these days, especially them what live here in Shantytown. It ain't safe for you. I ain't been in Shantytown but 2 days, but I hear them talk about you. And yesterday when you drove by and them trashy black winches holler at you, I recognized you, but you went by so fast I couldn't catch you. But I sure tanned the hides of them niggers, I sure did. And you notice there ain't none of them around here today?
I did notice, and I certainly thank you, Sam. Well, how would you like to be my carriage man?
Miss Scarlet, thank you, ma'am. But I specs I better go to Tara.
Big Sam looked down, and his bare toe traced aimless marks in the road. There was a furtive uneasiness about him. Now why? I'll pay you good wages. You must stay with me. The big black face, stupid and easily read as a child's, looked up at her, and there was fear in it. He came closer, and leaning over the side of the buggy, whispered,
"Miss Scarlet, I got to get out of Atlanta. I got to get to Tara where they won't find me. I done killed a man."
"A darky?"
"No'm. A white man. A Yankee soldier, and is looking for me. That the reason I'm here at Chantytown."
"How did it happen?"
"He was drunk, and he said something I couldn't take no ways. And I got my hands on his neck. And I didn't mean to kill him, Miss Scarlet. But my hands is powerful strong. And 'fore I knowed it, he was killed. And I was so scared I didn't know what to do. So I come out here to hide, and when I seed you go by yesterday, I says, 'Bless God, dear Miss Scarlet, she take care of me. She ain't going to let the Yankees get me. She send me back to Tara.'"
"You say that after you? They know you did it?"
"Yes'm. I's so big there ain't no mistaking me. I specs I's the biggest nigger in Atlanta. They done been out here already after me last night, but a nigger gal, she hid me in a cave over in the woods till they was gone."
Scarlet sat frowning for a moment. She was not in the least alarmed or distressed that Sam had committed murder, but she was disappointed that she couldn't have him as a driver. A big negro like Sam would be as good a bodyguard as Archie. Well, she must get him safe to Tara somehow, for of course the authorities mustn't get him. He was too valuable a darky to be hanged. Why, he was the best foreman Tara had ever had. It didn't enter Scarlet's mind that he was free. He still belonged to her, like Pork and Mammy and Peter and Cookie and Prissy. He was still one of our family, and as such must be protected. "I'll send you to Tara tonight," she said finally. "Now, Sam, I've got to drive out the road a piece, but I ought to be back here before sundown. You'll be waiting here for me when I come back. Don't tell anyone where you are going. And if you've got a hat, bring it along to hide your face."
"I ain't got no hat."
"Well, here's a quarter. You buy a hat from one of those shanty darkies and meet me here."
"Yes'm."
His face glowed with relief at once more having someone to tell him what to do. Scarlet drove on thoughtfully. Will would certainly welcome a good field hand at Tara. Pork had never been any good in the fields and never would be any good. With Sam on the place, Pork could come to Atlanta and join Dilsey, as she had promised him when Gerald died. When she reached the mill, the sun was setting, and it was later than she cared to be out. Johnny Gallagher was standing in the doorway of the miserable shack that served as cook room for the little lumber camp. Sitting on a log in front of the slab-sided shack that was their sleeping quarters were four or five convicts Scarlet had apportioned to Johnny's mill. Their convict uniforms were dirty and foul with sweat. Shackles clanked between their ankles when they moved tiredly. And there was an air of apathy and despair about them. They were a thin, unwholesome lot, Scarlet thought, peering sharply at them. And when she had leased them so short a time before, they were an upstanding crew. They didn't even raise their eyes as she dismounted from the buggy, but Johnny turned toward her, carelessly dragging off his hat. His little brown face was as hard as a nut as he greeted her. "I don't like the look of the men," she said abruptly. "They don't look well." "Where's the other one?"
"Says he's sick," said Johnny laconically. "He's in the bunkhouse."
"What ails him?"
"Laziness mostly."
"I'll go see him."
"Don't do that. He's probably naked."
"I'll tend to him. He'll be back at work tomorrow." Scarlet hesitated and saw one of the convicts raise a weary head and give Johnny a stare of intense hatred before he looked at the ground again. "Have you been whipping these men?"
"Now, Mrs. Kennedy, begging your pardon, who's running this mill? You put me in charge and told me to run it. You said I'd have a free hand. You ain't got no complaints to make of me, have you? Ain't I making twice as much for you as Mr. Elsing did?"
"Yes, you are," said Scarlet, but a shiver went over her, like a goose walking across her grave. There was something sinister about this camp with its ugly shacks. Something which had not been here when Hugh Elsing had it. There was a loneliness, an isolation about it that chilled her. These convicts were so far away from everything, so completely at the mercy of Johnny Gallagher, and if he chose to whip them or otherwise mistreat them, she would probably never know about it. The convicts would be afraid to complain to her for fear of worse punishment after she was gone. The men look thin. Are you giving them enough to eat? God knows I spend enough money on their food to make them fat as hogs. The flour and pork alone cost $30 last month. What are you giving them for supper? She stepped over to the cook shack and looked in. A fat mulatto woman, who was leaning over a rusty old stove, dropped a half-curtsy as she saw Scarlet, and went on stirring a pot in which black-eyed peas were cooking. Scarlet knew Johnny Gallagher lived with her, but thought it best to ignore the fact. She saw that, except for the peas and a pan of corn pone, there was no other food being prepared. "Haven't you got anything else for these men?"
"No'm."
"Haven't you got any side meat in these peas?"
"No'm."
"No boiling bacon in the peas? But black-eyed peas are no good without bacon. There's no strength in them. Why isn't there any bacon?"
"Mr. Johnny, he say there ain't no use putting in no side meat."
"You'll put bacon in. Where do you keep your supplies?" The Negro woman rolled frightened eyes toward the small closet that served as a pantry, and Scarlet threw the door open. There was an open barrel of cornmeal on the floor, a small sack of flour, a pound of coffee, a little sugar, a gallon jug of sorghum, and two hams. One of the hams sitting on the shelf had been recently cooked, and only one or two slices had been cut from it. Scarlet turned in fury on Johnny Gallagher and met his coldly angry gaze. "Where are the 5 sacks of white flour I sent out last week? And the sugar sack and the coffee? And I have 5 hams sent, and 10 pounds of side meat, and God knows how many bushels of yams and Irish potatoes. Well, where are they? You can't have used them all in a week if you fed the men 5 meals a day. You've sold them. That's what you've done, you thief. Sold my good supplies and put the money in your pocket and fed these men on dried peas and corn pone. No wonder they look so thin. Get out of the way." She stormed past him to the doorway. "You, man, there on the end. Yes, you. Come here." The man rose and walked awkwardly toward her, his shackles clanking, and she saw that his bare ankles were red and raw from the chafing of the iron. "When did you last have ham?" The man looked down at the ground. "Speak up." Still the man stood silent and abject. Finally he raised his eyes, looked Scarlet in the face imploringly, and dropped his gaze again. "Scared to talk, eh? Well, go in that pantry and get that ham off the shelf. Rebecca, give him your knife. Take it out to those men and divide it up. Rebecca, make some biscuits and coffee for the men, and serve plenty of sorghum. Stop now so I can see you do it."
"That's Mr. Johnny's private flour and coffee," Rebecca muttered frightenedly.
"Mr. Johnny's my foot. I suppose it's his private ham, too. You do what I say. Get busy. Johnny Gallagher, come out to the buggy with me." She stalked across the littered yard and climbed into the buggy, noticing with grim satisfaction that the men were tearing at the ham and cramming bits into their mouths voraciously. They looked as if they feared it would be taken from them at any minute. "You are a rare scoundrel," she cried furiously to Johnny, as he stood at the wheel, his hat pushed back from his lowering brow. "And you can just hand over to me the price of my supplies. In the future, I'll bring you provisions every day instead of ordering them by the month. Then you can't cheat me."
"In the future I won't be here," said Johnny Gallagher.
"You mean you are quitting?" For a moment it was on Scarlet's hot tongue to cry, "Go and good riddance!" But the cool hand of caution stopped her. If Johnny should quit, what would she do? He had been doubling the amount of lumber Hugh turned out. And just now she had a big order, the biggest she had ever had, and a rush order at that. She had to get that lumber into Atlanta. If Johnny quit, whom would she get to take over the mill? Yes, I'm quitting. You put me in complete charge here, and you told me that all you expected of me was as much lumber as I could possibly get out. You didn't tell me how to run my business then, and I'm not able to have you start now. How I get the lumber out is no affair of yours. You can't complain that I've fallen down on my bargain. I've made money for you, and I've earned my salary. And what I could pick up on the side, too. And here you come out here interfering, asking questions, and breaking my authority in front of the men. How can you expect me to keep discipline after this? What if the men do get an occasional lick? The lazy scum deserve worse. What if they ain't fed up and pampered? They don't deserve nothing better. Either you tend to your business and let me tend to mine, or I quit tonight. His hard little face looked flintier than ever, and Scarlet was in a quandary. If he quit tonight, what would she do? She couldn't stay here all night guarding the convicts. Something of her dilemma showed in her eyes, for Johnny's expression changed subtly, and some of the hardness went out of his face. There was an easy, agreeable note in his voice when he spoke. "It's getting late, Mrs. Kennedy, and you'd better be getting on home. We ain't going to fall out over a little thing like this, are we? Suppose you take $10 out of my next month's wages, and let's call it square." Scarlett's eyes went unwillingly to the miserable group gnawing on the ham, and she thought of the sick man lying in the windy shack. She ought to get rid of Johnny Gallagher. He was a thief and a brutal man. There was no telling what he did to the convicts when she wasn't there. But on the other hand, he was smart, and God knows she needed a smart man. Well, she couldn't part with him now. He was making money for her. She'd just have to see to it that the convicts got their proper rations in the future. "I'll take $20 out of your wages," she said shortly, "and I'll be back and discuss the matter further in the morning." She picked up the reins. But she knew there would be no further discussion. She knew that the matter had ended there, and she knew Johnny knew it. As she drove off down the path to the Decatur Road, her conscience battled with her desire for money. She knew she had no business exposing human lives to the hard little man's mercies. If he should cause the death of one of them, she would be as guilty as he was, for she had kept him in charge after learning of his brutalities. But, on the other hand... Well, on the other hand, men had no business getting to be convicts. If they broke laws and got caught, then they deserved what they got. This partly salved her conscience. But as she drove down the road, the dull, thin faces of the convicts would keep coming back into her mind. "Oh, I'll think of them later," she decided, and pushed the thought into the lumber room of her mind, and shut the door upon it. The sun had completely gone when she reached the bend in the road above Shantytown, and the woods about her were dark. With the disappearance of the sun, a bitter chill had fallen on the twilight world, and a cold wind blew through the dark woods, making the bare boughs crack and the dead leaves rustle. She had never been out this late by herself, and she was uneasy and wished herself home. Big Sam was nowhere to be seen, and as she drew rein to wait for him, she worried about his absence, fearing the Yankees might have already picked him up. Then she heard footsteps coming up the path from the settlement, and a sigh of relief went through her lips. She'd certainly dress Sam down for keeping her waiting. But it wasn't Sam who came round the bend. It was a big, ragged white man and a squat black negro with shoulders and chest like a gorilla. Swiftly she flapped the reins on the horse's back and clutched the pistol. The horse started to trot and suddenly shied as the white man threw up his hand. "Lady,"
he said. "Can you give me a quarter? I'm sure hungry."
"Get out of the way," she answered, keeping her voice as steady as she could. "I haven't got any money. Get up." With a sudden, swift movement, the man's hand was on the horse's bridle.
"Grab her,"
he shouted to the Negro.
"She's probably got her money in her bosom."
What happened next was like a nightmare to Scarlet. And it all happened so quickly. She brought up her pistol swiftly, and some instinct told her not to fire at the white man for fear of shooting the horse. As the Negro came running to the buggy, his black face twisted in a leering grin, she fired point-blank at him. Whether or not she hit him, she never knew. But the next minute the pistol was wrenched from her hand by a grasp that almost broke her wrist. The Negro was beside her, so close that she could smell the rank odor of him as he tried to drag her over the buggy side. With her one free hand, she fought madly, clawing at his face. And then she felt his big hand at her throat, and with a ripping noise, her basque was torn open from neck to waist. Then the black hand fumbled between her breasts, and terror and revulsion such as she had never known came over her, and she screamed like an insane woman. "Shut her up! Drag her out!" cried the white man. And the black hand fumbled across Scarlet's face to her mouth. She bit as savagely as she could and then screamed again, and through her screaming she heard the white man swear and realized that there was a third man in the dark road. The black hand dropped from her mouth and the Negro leaped away as Big Sam charged at him.
"Run, Miss Scarlet,"
yelled Sam, grappling with the Negro. And Scarlet, shaking and screaming, clutched up the reins and whip and laid them both over the horse. It went off at a jump, and she felt the wheels pass over something soft, something resistant. It was the white man who lay in the road where Sam had knocked him down. Maddened by terror, she lashed the horse again and again, and it struck a gate that made the buggy rock and sway. Through her terror, she was conscious of the sound of feet running behind her, and she screamed at the horse to go faster. If that black ape got her again, she would die before he even got his hands upon her. A voice yelled behind her, "Miss Scarlet, stop!" Without slacking, she looked trembling over her shoulder and saw Big Sam racing down the road behind her, his long legs working like hard-driven pistons. She drew rein as he came up, and he flung himself into the buggy, his big body crowding her to one side. Sweat and blood were streaming down his face as he panted.
"Is you hurt? Did they hurt you?"
She could not speak, but seeing the direction of his eyes and their quick averting, she realized that her basque was open to the waist and her bare bosom and corset cover were showing. With a shaking hand, she clutched the two edges together, and bowing her head began to cry in terrified sobs.
"Give me them lines," said Sam, snatching the reins from her. "Hoss make tracks."
The whip cracked, and the startled horse went off at a wild gallop that threatened to throw the buggy into the ditch.
"I hope I done killed that black baboon. But I didn't wait to find out," he panted. "But if he harmed you, Miss Scarlet, I'll go back and make sure of it."
"No, no! Drive on quickly," she sobbed. Chapter 45. That night, when Frank deposited her and Aunt Pity and the children at Melanie's and rode off down the street with Ashley, Scarlet could have burst with rage and hurt. How could he go off to a political meeting on this of all nights in the world? A political meeting! And on the same night when she had been attacked, when anything might have happened to her. It was unfeeling and selfish of him. But then, he had taken the whole affair with maddening calm. Ever since Sam had carried her sobbing into the house, her basque gaping to the waist. He hadn't clawed his beard even once when she cried out her story. He had just questioned gently, "Sugar, are you hurt or just scared?" Wrath mingling with her tears, she had been unable to answer, and Sam had volunteered that she was just scared.
"I got there before they done mourn tear her dress."
"You're a good boy, Sam, and I won't forget what you've done. if there's anything I can do for you.
Yes, sir?
You can send me to Terra quick as you can. The Yankees is after me.
Frank had listened to his statement calmly, too, and had asked no questions. He had looked very much as he did the night Tony came beating on their door, as though this was an exclusively masculine affair and one to be handled with a minimum of words and emotions. You go get in the buggy. I'll have Peter drive you as far as Rough and Ready tonight, and you can hide in the woods till morning and then catch the train to Jonesboro. It'll be safer. Now, Sugar, stop crying. It's all over now, and you aren't really hurt. Miss Pity, could I have your smelling salts? And, Mammy, fetch Miss Scarlet a glass of wine. Scarlet had burst into renewed tears, this time tears of rage. She wanted comforting, indignation, threats of vengeance. She would even have preferred him storming at her, saying that this was just what he had warned her would happen. Anything rather than have him take it all so casually and treat her danger as a matter of small moment. He was nice and gentle, of course, but in an absent way, as if he had something far more important on his mind. And that important thing had turned out to be a small political meeting. She could hardly believe her ears when he told her to change her dress and get ready for him to escort her over to Melanie's for the evening. He must know how harrowing her experience had been. Must know she didn't want to spend an evening at Melanie's when her tired body and jangled nerves cried out for the warm relaxation of bed and blankets, with a hot brick to make her toes tingle and a hot toddy to soothe her fears. If he really loved her, nothing could have forced him from her side, on this of all nights. He would have stayed home and held her hand, and told her over and over that he would have died if anything had happened to her. And when he came home tonight, and she had him alone, she would certainly tell him so. Melanie's small parlor looked as serene as it usually did on nights when Frank and Ashley were away, and the women gathered together to sew. The room was warm and cheerful in the firelight. The lamp on the table shed a quiet yellow glow on the four smooth heads bent to their needlework. Four skirts billowed modestly. Eight small feet were daintily placed on low hassocks. The quiet breathing of Wade, Ella, and Beau came through the open door of the nursery. Archie sat on a stool by the hearth, his back against the fireplace, his cheek distended with tobacco, whittling industriously on a bit of wood. The contrast between the dirty, hairy old man and the four neat, fastidious ladies was as great as though he were a grizzled, vicious old watchdog and they four small kittens. Melanie's soft voice, tinged with indignation, went on and on as she told of the recent outburst of temperament on the part of the lady harpists. Unable to agree with a gentleman's glee club as to the program for their next recital, the ladies had waited on Melanie that afternoon and announced their intention of withdrawing completely from the musical circle. It had taken all of Melanie's diplomacy to persuade them to defer their decision. Scarlet, overwrought, could have screamed, "Oh, damn the lady harpists!" She wanted to talk about her dreadful experience. She was bursting to relate it in detail, so she could ease her own fright by frightening the others. She wanted to tell how brave she had been, just to assure herself by the sound of her own words that she had, indeed, been brave. But every time she brought up the subject, Melanie deftly steered the conversation into other and innocuous channels. This irritated Scarlet almost beyond endurance. They were as mean as Frank. How could they be so calm and placid when she had just escaped so terrible a fate? They weren't even displaying common courtesy in denying her the relief of talking about it. The events of the afternoon had shaken her more than she cared to admit, even to herself. Every time she thought of that malignant black face peering at her from the shadows of the twilight forest road, she fell to trembling. When she thought of the black hand at her bosom, and what would have happened if Big Sam had not appeared, she bent her head lower and squeezed her eyes tightly shut. The longer she sat silent in the peaceful room, trying to sew, listening to Melanie's voice,
the tighter her nerves stretched. She felt that at any moment she would actually hear them break, with the same pinging sound a banjo string makes when it snaps. Archie's whittling annoyed her, and she frowned at him. Suddenly it seemed odd that he should be sitting there occupying himself with a piece of wood. Usually he lay flat on the sofa, during the evenings when he was on guard, and slept and snored so violently that his long beard leaped into the air with each rumbling breath. It was odder still that neither Melanie nor India hinted to him that he should spread a paper on the floor to catch his litter of shavings. He had already made a perfect mess on the hearth rug, but they didn't seem to have noticed it. While she watched him, Archie turned suddenly toward the fire and spat a stream of tobacco juice on it with such vehemence that India, Melanie, and Pity leaped as though a bomb had exploded.
"Need you expectorate so loudly?" cried India in a voice that cracked with nervous annoyance.
Scarlet looked at her in surprise, for India was always so self-contained. Archie gave her look for look.
"I reckon I do," he answered coldly, and spat again.
Melanie gave a little frowning glance at India.
"I was always so glad dear Papa didn't chew," began Pity.
And Melanie, her frown creasing deeper, swung on her and spoke sharper words than Scarlet had ever heard her speak.
"Oh, do hush, Auntie. You're so tactless."
"Oh, dear."
Pity dropped her sewing in her lap and her mouth pursed up in a hurt.
"I declare, I don't know what ails you all tonight. You and India are just as jumpy and cross as two old sticks."
No one answered her. Melanie didn't even apologize for her crossness, but went back to her sewing with small violence.
"You're taking stitches an inch long," declared Pity with some satisfaction. "You'll have to take every one of them out. What's the matter with you?"
But Melanie still didn't answer. Was there anything the matter with them, Scarlet wondered? Had she been too absorbed with her own fears to notice?
Yes. Despite Melanie's attempts to make the evening appear like any one of 50 they had all spent together, there was a difference due to their alarm and shock at what had happened that afternoon.
Scarlet stole glances at her companions and intercepted a look from India. It discomforted her because it was a long measuring glance that carried in its cold depth something stronger than hate, something more insulting than contempt.
"As though she thought I was to blame for what happened," Scarlet thought indignantly.
India turned from her to Archie, and all annoyance at him gone from her face, she gave him a look of veiled, anxious inquiry. But he didn't meet her eyes. He did, however, look at Scarlet, staring at her in the same cold, hard way India had done. Silence fell dully in the room, as Melanie didn't take up the conversation again, and in the silence, Scarlet heard the rising wind outside. It suddenly began to be a most unpleasant evening. Now she began to feel the tension in the air, and she wondered if it had been present all during the evening, and she too upset to notice it.
About Archie's face there was an alert, waiting look, and his tufted, hairy old ears seemed pricked up like a lynx's.
There was a severely repressed uneasiness about Melanie and India that made them raise their heads from their sewing at each sound of hooves in the road, at each groan of bare branches under the wailing wind, at each scuffing sound of dry leaves tumbling across the lawn. They started at each soft snap of burning logs on the hearth, as if they were stealthy footsteps. Something was wrong, and Scarlet wondered what it was. Something was afoot, and she didn't know about it. A glance at Aunt Pity's plump, guileless face, screwed up in a pout, told her that the old lady was as ignorant as she. But Archie and Melanie and India knew. In the silence she could almost feel the thoughts of India and Melanie whirling as madly as squirrels in a cage. They knew something, were waiting for something, despite their efforts to make things appear as usual. and their inner unease communicated itself to Scarlet, making her more nervous than before. Handling her needle awkwardly, she jabbed it into her thumb, and with a little scream of pain and annoyance that made them all jump, she squeezed it until a bright red drop appeared. "I'm just too nervous to sew," she declared, throwing her mending to the floor. "I'm nervous enough to scream. I want to go home and go to bed. And Frank knew it, and he oughtn't to have gone out. He talks about protecting women against darkies and carpetbaggers, and when the time comes for him to do some protecting, where is he? At home, taking care of me? No, indeed. He's gallivanting around with a lot of other men who don't do anything but talk, and..." Her snapping eyes came to rest on India's face, and she paused. India was breathing fast, and her pale, lashless eyes were fastened on Scarlet's face with a deadly coldness. "If it won't pain you too much, India," she broke off sarcastically, "I'd be much obliged if you'd tell me why you've been staring at me all evening. Has my face turned green or something?" "It won't pain me to tell you." "I'll do it with pleasure," said India, and her eyes glittered. "I hate to see you underrate a fine man like Mr. Kennedy, when if you knew—" "India," said Melanie warningly, her hands clenching on her sewing. "I think I know my husband better than you do," said Scarlet. The prospect of a quarrel, the first open quarrel she had ever had with India, making her spirits rise and her nervousness depart. Melanie's eyes caught India's, and reluctantly India closed her lips. But almost instantly she spoke again, and her voice was cold with hate. "You make me sick, Scarlet O'Hara, talking about being protected. You don't care about being protected. If you did, you never have exposed yourself as you have done all these months, prissing yourself about this town, showing yourself off to strange men, hoping they'll admire you. What happened to you this afternoon was just what you deserved, and if there was any justice, you'd have gotten worse." "Oh, India, hush!" cried Melanie.
"Let her talk," cried Scarlet. "I'm enjoying it. I always knew she hated me, and she was too much of a hypocrite to admit it. If she thought anyone would admire her, she'd be walking the streets naked from dawn till dark."
India was on her feet, her lean body quivering with insult.
"I do hate you," she said in a clear but trembling voice. "But it hasn't been hypocrisy that has kept me quiet. It's something you can't understand, not possessing any common courtesy, common good breeding. It's the realization that if all of us don't hang together and submerge our own small hates, we can't expect to beat the Yankees. But you've done all you could to lower the prestige of decent people, working and bringing shame on a good husband, giving Yankees and riff-raff the right to laugh at us and make insulting remarks about our lack of gentility. Yankees don't know that you aren't one of us and never have been. Yankees haven't sense enough to know that you haven't any gentility, and when you've ridden about the woods exposing yourself to attack, you exposed every well-behaved woman in town to attack by putting temptation in the ways of darkies and mean white trash. And you put our menfolk's lives in danger because they've got to—"
"My God, India!" cried Melanie. And even in her wrath, Scarlet was stunned to hear Melanie take the Lord's name in vain.
"You must hush. She doesn't know when she—" "You must hush. You promised—"
"Oh, girls,"
pleaded Miss Pittypat, her lips trembling.
"What don't I know?"
Scarlet was on her feet, furious, facing the coldly blazing India and imploring Melanie.
"Guinea hens," said Archie suddenly, and his voice was contemptuous.
Before anyone could rebuke him, his grizzled head went up sharply, and he rose swiftly.
"Somebody coming up the walk. 'Tain't Mr. Wilkes, neither. Cease your cackle."
There was male authority in his voice, and the women stood suddenly silent, anger fading swiftly from their faces, as he stumped across the room to the door.
"Who's there?"
he questioned before the caller even knocked.
"Captain Butler, let me in."
Melanie was across the floor so swiftly that her hoops swayed up violently, revealing her pantalettes to the knees, and before Archie could put his hand on the knob, she flung the door open. Rhett Butler stood in the doorway, his black slouch hat low over his eyes, the wild wind whipping his cape about him in snapping folds. For once his good manners had deserted him. He neither took off his hat nor spoke to the others in the room. He had eyes for no one but Melanie, and he spoke abruptly without greeting. "Where have they gone? Tell me quickly. It's life or death." Scarlet and Pity, startled and bewildered, looked at each other in wonderment, and, like a lean old cat, India streaked across the room to Melanie's side.
"Don't tell him anything," she cried swiftly. "He's a spy, a scalawag."
Rhett didn't even favor her with a glance. "Quickly, Mrs. Wilkes. There may still be time." Melanie seemed in a paralysis of terror, and only stared into his face.
"What on earth?" began Scarlet.
"Shut your mouth," directed Archie briefly. "You too, Miss Belly. Get the hell out of here, you damn scalawag."
"No, Archie, no," cried Melanie. And she put a shaking hand on Rhett's arm, as though to protect him from Archie. "What has happened? How did you know?"
On Rhett's dark face, impatience fought with courtesy. "Good God, Mrs. Wilkes, they've all been under suspicion since the beginning. Only they've been too clever, until tonight." "How do I know? I was playing poker tonight with two drunken Yankee captains, and they let it out. The Yankees knew there'd be trouble tonight, and they've prepared for it. The fools have walked into a trap." For a moment, it was as though Melanie swayed under the impact of a heavy blow, and Rhett's arm went around her waist to steady her.
"Don't tell him. He's trying to trap you," cried India, glaring at Rhett. "Didn't you hear him say he'd been with the Yankee officers tonight?"
Still, Rhett didn't look at her. His eyes were bent insistently on Melanie's white face. "Tell me, where did they go? Have they a meeting place?" Despite her fear and incomprehension, Scarlet thought she had never seen a blanker, more expressionless face than Rhett's. But evidently Melanie saw something else, something that made her give her trust. She straightened her small body away from the steadying arm and said quietly, but with a voice that shook,
"Out the Decatur Road near Shantytown. They meet in the cellar of the old Sullivan plantation, the one that's half burned."
"Thank you. I'll ride fast. When the Yankees come here, none of you know anything." He was gone so swiftly, his black cape melting into the night, that they could hardly realize he had been there at all until they heard the spattering of gravel and the mad pounding of a horse going off at full gallop.
"The Yankees coming here?" cried Pity, and her small feet turning under her, she collapsed on the sofa, too frightened for tears. "What's it all about? What did he mean? If you don't tell me, I'll go crazy."
Scarlet laid hands on Melanie and shook her violently, as if by force she could shake an answer from her.
"Mean? It means you've probably been the cause of Ashley's and Mr. Kennedy's death."
In spite of the agony of fear, there was a note of triumph in India's voice.
"Stop shaking Melly. She's going to faint."
"No, I'm not," whispered Melanie, clutching the back of a chair.
My God, I don't understand. Kill Ashley. Please, somebody tell me."
Archie's voice, like a rusty hinge, cut through Scarlet's words.
"Sit down," he ordered briefly. "Pick up your sewing. Sew like nothing has happened. For all we know, the Yankees might have been spying on this house in sundown. Set down, I say, and so."
Trembling, they obeyed, even Pity picking up a sock and holding it in shaking fingers, while her eyes, wide as a frightened child's, went around the circle for an explanation.
"Where is Ashley? What's happened to him, Melly?" cried Scarlet. "Where's your husband? Aren't you interested in him?"
India's pale eyes blazed with insane malice as she crumpled and straightened the torn towel she had been mending.
"India, please."
Melanie had mastered her voice, but her white, shaken face and tortured eyes showed the strain under which she was laboring.
"Scarlet, perhaps we should have told you, but you had been through so much this afternoon that that Frank didn't think. And you were always so outspoken against the Klan."
The clan. At first, Scarlet spoke the word as if she had never heard it before, and had no comprehension of its meaning, and then...
The clan? She almost screamed it. Ashley isn't in the clan. Frank can't be. Oh, he promised me. Of course Mr. Kennedy is in the clan, and Ashley too, and all the men we know, cried India. They're men, aren't they? And white men, and southerners. You should have been proud of him instead of making him sneak out as though it were something shameful and... You all have known all along and I didn't.
We were afraid it would upset you, said Melanie sorrowfully.
Then that's where they go when they're supposed to be at the political meetings. Oh, he promised me. Now the Yankees will come and take my mills and the store and put him in jail. Oh, what did Rhett Butler mean?
India's eyes met Melanie's in wild fear. Scarlet rose, flinging her sewing down.
If you don't tell me, I'm going downtown and find out. I'll ask everybody I see until I find...
Set, said Archie, fixing her with his eye. I'll tell you. Because you went gallivanting this afternoon and got yourself into trouble through your own fault. Mr. Wilkes and Mr. Kennedy and the other men are out tonight to kill that there nigger and that there white man if they can catch him, and wipe out that whole shantytown settlement. And if what that scalawag said is true, the Yankees suspected something or got wind somehow, and they've sent out troops to lay for 'em. And our men have walked into a trap. And if what Butler said weren't true, then he's a spy, and he's going to turn them up to the Yankees, and they'll get killed just the same. And if he does turn them up, then I'll kill him, if it's the last deed of my life. And if they ain't killed, then they'll all have to light out here for Texas and lay low and maybe never come back. It's all your fault, and there's blood on your hands.
Anger wiped out the fear from Melanie's face, as she saw comprehension come slowly across Scarlet's face, and then horror follow swiftly. She rose and put her hand on Scarlet's shoulder.
Another word, and you go out of this house, Archie, she said sternly. It's not her fault. She only did what she felt she had to do. And our men did what they felt they had to do. People must do what they must do. We don't all think alike or act alike, and it's wrong to judge others by ourselves. How can you and India say such cruel things when her husband as well as mine maybe...
Hark, interrupted Archie softly. Set, ma'am. There's horses.
Melanie sank into a chair, picked up one of Ashley's shirts, and bowing her head over it, unconsciously began to tear the frills into small ribbons. The sound of hooves grew louder as horses trotted up to the house. There was the jangling of bits and the strain of leather and the sound of voices. As the hooves stopped in front of the house, one voice rose above the others in a command, and the listeners heard feet going through the side yard toward the back porch. They felt that a thousand inimical eyes looked at them through the unshaded front window, and the four women, with fear in their hearts, bent their heads and plied their needles. Scarlet's heart screamed in her breast.
I've killed Ashley. I've killed him.
And in that wild moment, she didn't even think that she might have killed Frank, too. She had no room in her mind for any picture save that of Ashley lying at the feet of Yankee cavalrymen, his fair hair dappled with blood. As the harsh, rapid knocking sounded at the door, she looked at Melanie, and saw come over the small, strained face a new expression, an expression as blank as she had just seen on Rhett Butler's face, the bland, blank look of a poker player bluffing a game with only two deuces.
Archie opened the door, she said quietly.
Slipping his knife into his boot top and loosening the pistol in his trouser band, Archie stumped over to the door and flung it open. Pity gave a little squeak, like a mouse who feels the trap snap down, as she saw massed in the doorway a Yankee captain and a squad of bluecoats. But the other said nothing. Scarlet saw with the faintest feeling of relief that she knew this officer. He was Captain Tom Jaffrey, one of Rhett's friends. She had sold him lumber to build his house. She knew him to be a gentleman. Perhaps, as he was a gentleman, he wouldn't drag them away to prison.
He recognized her instantly, and, taking off his hat, bowed, somewhat embarrassed.
"Good evening, Mrs. Kennedy. And which of you ladies is Mrs. Wilkes?"
"I am Mrs. Wilkes," answered Melanie, rising, and for all her smallness, dignity flowed from her. "And to what do I owe this intrusion?"
The eyes of the captain flickered quickly about the room, resting for an instant on each face, passing quickly from their faces to the table and the hat rack, as though looking for signs of male occupancy.
"I should like to speak to Mr. Wilkes and Mr. Kennedy, if you please."
"They are not here," said Melanie, a chill in her soft voice.
"Are you sure?" "Don't you question Ms. Wilkes' word," said Archie, his beard bristling.
"I beg your pardon, Mrs. Wilkes. I meant no disrespect. If you give me your word, I will not search the house."
"You have my word, but search if you like. They're at a meeting downtown at Mr. Kennedy's store."
"They're not at the store. There was no meeting tonight," answered the captain grimly. "We'll wait outside until they return."
He bowed briefly and went out, closing the door behind him. Those in the house heard a sharp order, muffled by the wind.
"Surround the house, a man at each window and door."
There was a tramping of feet. Scarlet checked a start of terror as she dimly saw bearded faces peering in the windows at them. Melanie sat down and, with a hand that did not tremble, reached for a book on the table. It was a ragged copy of Les Misérables, that book which caught the fancy of the Confederate soldiers. They had read it by campfire light, and took some grim pleasure in calling it Les Misérables. She opened it at the middle and began to read in a clear, monotonous voice.
"So," commanded Archie in a hoarse whisper, and the three women, nerved by Melanie's cool voice, picked up their sewing and bowed their heads.
How long Melanie read beneath that circle of watching eyes, Scarlet never knew, but it seemed hours. She didn't even hear a word that Melanie read. Now she was beginning to think of Frank as well as Ashley. So this was the explanation of his apparent calm this evening. He had promised her he would have nothing to do with the clan. Oh, this was just the kind of trouble she had feared would come upon them. All the work of this last year would go for nothing. All her struggles and fears and labor in rain and cold had been wasted. And who would have thought that spiritless old Frank would get himself mixed up in the hot-headed doings of the clan? Even at this minute he might be dead. And if he wasn't dead and the Yankees caught him, he'd be hanged. And Ashley, too. Her nails dug into her palms until four bright red crescents showed. How could Melanie read on and on so calmly when Ashley was in danger of being hanged, when he might be dead? But something in the cool, soft voice reading the sorrows of Jean Valjean steadied her, kept her from leaping to her feet and screaming. Her mind fled back to the night Tony Fontaine had come to them, hunted, exhausted, without money. If he hadn't reached their house and received money and a fresh horse, he would have been hanged long since. If Frank and Ashley weren't dead at this very minute, they were in Tony's position, only worse. With a house surrounded by soldiers, they couldn't come home and get money and clothes without being captured. And probably every house up and down the street had a similar guard of Yankees, so they couldn't apply to friends for aid. Even now they might be riding wildly through the night, bound for Texas. But Rhett. Perhaps Rhett had reached them in time. Rhett always had plenty of cash in his pocket. Perhaps he would lend them enough to see them through. But that was queer. Why should Rhett bother himself about Ashley's safety? Certainly he disliked him. Certainly he professed a contempt for him. Then why? But this riddle was swallowed up in a renewed fear for the safety of Ashley and Frank. "Oh, it's all my fault," she wailed to herself. "India and Archie spoke the truth. It's all my fault. But I never thought either of them was foolish enough to join the clan. And I never thought anything would really happen to me."
But I couldn't have done otherwise. Melly spoke the truth. People have to do what they have to do. And I had to keep the mills going. I had to have money. And now I'll probably lose it all, and somehow it's all my fault. After a long time, Melanie's voice faltered, trailed off, and was silent. She turned her head toward the window and stared as though no Yankee soldier stared back from behind the glass. The others raised their heads, caught by her listening pose. And they too listened. There was a sound of horses' feet and of singing, deadened by the closed windows and doors, borne away by the wind but still recognizable. It was the most hated and hateful of songs, the song about Sherman's men marching through Georgia. And Rhett Butler was singing it. Hardly had he finished the first lines when two other voices, drunken voices, assailed him, enraged, foolish voices that stumbled over words and blurred them together. There was a quick command from Captain Jaffrey on the front porch, and the rapid tramp of feet. But even before these sounds arose, the ladies looked at one another, stunned, for the drunken voices expostulating with Rhett were those of Ashley and Hugh Elsing. Voices rose louder on the front walk, Captain Jaffrey's curt and questioning, Hugh shrill with foolish laughter, Rhett's deep and reckless, and Ashley's queer, unreal shouting.
"What the hell? What the hell?"
"That can't be Ashley," thought Scarlet wildly. "He never gets drunk. And Rhett... why, when Rhett's drunk, he gets quieter and quieter. Never loud like that."
Melody rose, and with her, Archie rose. They heard the captain's sharp voice.
"These two men are under arrest."
And Archie's hand closed over his pistol butt.
"No," whispered Melody firmly. "No, leave it to me."
There was, in her face, the same look Scarlet had seen that day at Tara, when Melanie had stood at the top of the steps looking down at the dead Yankee, her weak wrist weighed down by the heavy saber, a gentle and timid soul nerved by circumstances to the caution and fury of a tigress. She threw the front door open.
"Bring him in, Captain Butler," she called in a clear tone that bit with venom. "I suppose you've gotten him intoxicated again. Bring him in."
From the dark, windy walk, the Yankee captain spoke.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Wilkes, but your husband and Mr. Elsing are under arrest."
"Arrest? For what? For drunkenness? If everyone in Atlanta was arrested for drunkenness, the whole Yankee garrison would be in jail continually." "Well, bring him in, Captain Butler. That is, if you can walk yourself."
Scarlet's mind wasn't working quickly, and for a brief moment nothing made sense. She knew neither Rhett nor Ashley was drunk, and she knew Melanie knew they weren't drunk. Yet here was Melanie, usually so gentle and refined, screaming like a shrew, and in front of Yankees, too, that both of them were too drunk to walk. There was a short mumbled argument, punctuated with curses, and uncertain feet ascended the stairs. In the doorway appeared Ashley, white-faced, his head lolling, his bright hair tousled, his long body wrapped from neck to knees in Rhett's black cape. Hugh Elsing and Rhett, none too steady on their feet, supported him on either side, and it was obvious he would have fallen to the floor but for their aid. Behind them came the Yankee captain, his face a study of mingled suspicion and amusement. He stood in the open doorway with his men peering curiously over his shoulders, and the cold wind swept the house. Scarlet, frightened, puzzled, glanced at Melanie and back to the sagging Ashley, and then half-comprehension came to her. She started to cry out, "But he can't be drunk," and bit back the words. She realized she was witnessing a play, a desperate play on which lives hinged. She knew she wasn't part of it, nor was Aunt Pity, but the others were. And they were tossing cues to one another like actors in an oft-rehearsed drama. She understood only half, but she understood enough to keep silent. "Put him in the chair," cried Melanie indignantly. "And you, Captain Butler, leave this house immediately.
How dare you show your face here after getting him in this condition again?
The two men eased Ashley into a rocker, and Rhett, swaying, caught hold of the back of the chair to steady himself and addressed the captain with pain in his voice.
That's fine thanks, Agit, isn't it? For keeping the police from getting him and bringing him home and him yelling and trying to claw me.
And you, Hugh Elsing, I'm ashamed of you. What will your poor mother say, drunk and out with a Yankee-loving scalawag like Captain Butler? And, oh, Mr. Wilkes, how could you do such a thing?
Millie?
I ain't so very drunk, mumbled Ashley. And with the words fell forward and lay face down on the table, his head buried in his arms.
Archie, take him to his room and put him to bed.
As usual,
ordered Melanie. Aunt Pity, please run and fix the bed, and oh, she suddenly burst into tears. Oh, how could he? After he promised.
Archie already had his arm under Ashley's shoulder, and Pity, frightened and uncertain, was on her feet when the captain interposed.
Don't touch him. He's under arrest. Sergeant?
As the sergeant stepped into the room, his rifle at trail, Rhett, evidently trying to steady himself, put a hand on the captain's arm and, with difficulty, focused his eyes.
Tom, what are you arresting him for? He ain't so very drunk. I've seen him drunker.
Drunk be damned, cried the captain.
He can lie in the gutter for all I care. I'm no policeman. He and Mr. Elsing are under arrest for complicity in a Klan raid at Shantytown tonight. A nigger and a white man were killed. Mr. Wilkes was the ringleader in it.
Tonight?
Rhett began to laugh.
He laughed so hard that he sat down on the sofa and put his head in his hands.
Not tonight, Tom, he said when he could speak. These two have been with me tonight, ever since 8 o'clock, when they were supposed to be at the meeting.
With you, Rhett, but...
A frown came over the captain's forehead, and he looked uncertainly at the snoring Ashley and his weeping wife.
But where were you?
I don't like to say.
And Rhett shot a look of drunken cunning at Melanie.
You'd better say.
Let's go out on the porch, and I'll tell you where we were.
You'll tell me now.
Hate to say it in front of the ladies.
If you ladies will step out of the room...
I won't go,
cried Melanie, dabbing angrily at her eyes with her handkerchief.
I have a right to know. Where was my husband?
At Belle Watling's sporting house, said Rhett, looking abashed. He was there, and Hugh and Frank Kennedy and Dr. Meade and a whole lot of them. Had a party, big party, champagne, girls.
At Belle Watling's?
Melanie's voice rose until it cracked with such pain that all eyes turned frightenedly to her. Her hand went clutching at her bosom, and before Archie could catch her, she had fainted. Then a hubbub ensued, Archie picking her up, India running to the kitchen for water, Pity and Scarlet fanning her and slapping her wrists, while Hugh Elsing shouted over and over,
"Now you've done it! Now you've done it!"
"Now it'll be all over town," said Rhett savagely. "I hope you're satisfied, Tom. There won't be a wife in Atlanta who'll speak to a husband tomorrow."
"Rhett, I had no idea."
Though the chill wind was blowing through the open door on his back, the captain was perspiring.
"Look here. You take oath they were at Bell's?"
"Hell yes," growled Rhett.
"Go ask Belle herself if you don't believe me. Now let me carry Mrs. Wilkes to her room. Give it to me, Archie."
"Yes, I can carry her."
"Miss Pity, go ahead with the lamp."
He took Melanie's limp body from Archie's arms with ease.
"You get Mr. Wilkes to bed, Archie. I don't want to ever lay eyes or hands on him again after this night."
Pity's hand trembled so that the lamp was a menace to the safety of the house. But she held it and trotted ahead toward the dark bedroom. Archie, with a grunt, got an arm under Ashley and raised him. But I've got to arrest these men. Rhett turned in the dim hallway.
Arrest them in the morning, then. They can't run away in this condition. And I never knew before that it was illegal to get drunk in a sporting house. Good God, Tom, there are 50 witnesses to prove they weren't Bales.
There are always 50 witnesses to prove a Southerner was somewhere where he wasn't, said the captain morosely.
You come with me, Mr. Elsing. I'll parole Mr. Wilkes on the word of...
I am Mr. Wilkes' sister. I will answer for his appearance, said India coldly. Now will you please go? You've caused enough trouble for one night.
I regret it exceedingly.
The captain bowed awkwardly.
I only hope they can prove their presence at the, Mrs. Watling's house. Will you tell your brother that he must appear before the provost marshal tomorrow morning for questioning?
India bowed coldly and, putting her hand upon the doorknob, intimated silently that his speedy retirement would be welcome. The captain and the sergeant backed out, Hugh Elsing with them, and she slammed the door behind them. Without even looking at Scarlett, she went swiftly to each window and drew down the shade. Scarlett, her knees shaking, caught hold of the chair in which Ashley had been sitting to steady herself. Looking down at it, she saw that there was a dark, moist spot, larger than her hand, on the cushion in the back of the chair. Puzzled, her hand went over it, and, to her horror, a sticky red wetness appeared on her palm. "India," she whispered. "India! Ashley's... he's hurt." "You fool! Did you think it was really drunk?" India snapped down the last shade and started on flying feet for the bedroom, with Scarlett close behind her, her heart in her throat. Rhett's big body barred the doorway, but past his shoulder, Scarlett saw Ashley lying white and still on the bed. Melanie, strangely quick for one so recently in a faint, was rapidly cutting off his blood-soaked shirt with embroidery scissors. Archie held the lamp low over the bed to give light, and one of his gnarled fingers was on Ashley's wrist.
"Is he dead?" cried both girls together.
"No, just fainted from loss of blood. It's through his shoulder," said Rhett.
"Why did you bring him here, you fool?" cried India. "Let me go to him. Let me pass. Why did you bring him here to be arrested?"
"He was too weak to travel. There was nowhere else to bring him, Miss Wilkes. Besides, do you want him to be in exile like Tony Fontaine? Do you want a dozen of your neighbors to live in Texas under assumed names for the rest of their lives? There's a chance that we may get them all off if Bell..."
"Let me pass."
"No, Miss Wilkes. There's work for you. You must go for a doctor, not Dr. Meade. He's implicated in this and is probably explaining to the Yankees at this very minute. Get some other doctor. Are you afraid to go out alone at night?"
"No," said India, her pale eyes glittering. "I'm not afraid." She caught up Melanie's hooded cape, which was hanging on a hook in the hall. "I'll go for old Dr. Dean." The excitement went out of her voice as, with an effort, she forced calmness. "I'm sorry I called you a spy and a fool. I did not understand. I'm deeply grateful for what you've done for Ashley. But I despise you just the same."
"I appreciate frankness, and I thank you for it." Rhett bowed, and his lip curled down in an amused smile. "Now go quickly, and by back ways, and when you return, do not come in this house if you see signs of soldiers about."
India shot one more quick, anguished look at Ashley, and wrapping her cape about her, ran lightly down the hall to the back door and let herself out quietly into the night. Scarlett, straining her eyes past Rhett, felt her heart beat again as she saw Ashley's eyes open. Melanie snatched a folded towel from the washstand rack and pressed it against his streaming shoulder, and he smiled up weakly, reassuringly, into her face. Scarlett felt Rhett's hard, penetrating eyes upon her, knew that her heart was plain upon her face. But she didn't care. Ashley was bleeding, perhaps dying, and she who loved him had torn that hole through his shoulder. She wanted to run to the bed, sink down beside it, and clasp him to her, but her knees trembled so that she couldn't enter the room. Hand at her mouth, she stared while Melanie packed a fresh towel against his shoulder, pressing it hard as though she could force back the blood into his body. But the towel reddened as though by magic. How could a man bleed so much and still live? But thank God there was no bubble of blood at his lips. Oh, those frothy red bubbles, forerunners of death that she knew so well from the dreadful day of the battle at Peachtree Creek when the wounded had died on Aunt Pity's lawn with bloody mouths. "Brace up," said Rhett. And there was a hard, faintly jeering note in his voice. "He won't die. Now go take the lamp and hold it for Mrs. Wilkes. I need Archie to run errands." Archie looked across the lamp at Rhett. "I ain't taking no orders from you," he said briefly, shifting his wad of tobacco to the other cheek.
"You do what he says," said Melanie sternly, "and do it quickly. Do everything Captain Butler says. Scarlet, take the lamp." Scarlet went forward and took the lamp, holding it in both hands to keep from dropping it. Ashley's eyes had closed again. His bare chest heaved up slowly and sank quickly, and the red stream seeped from between Melanie's small, frantic fingers. Dimly she heard Archie stump across the room to Rhett and heard Rhett's low, rapid words. Her mind was so fixed upon Ashley that, of the first half-whispered words of Rhett, she only heard, "Take my horse. Tied outside. Ride like hell." Archie mumbled some question, and Scarlet heard Rhett reply, "The old Sullivan plantation. You'll find the robes pushed up the biggest chimney. Burn them." "Grunted Archie. "And there's two